Welcome to episode 5. I'm Adam McCubbin. I'm really excited today to share with you this podcast as there's a lot of valuable information in it. But before we get into the podcast today, I would like to invite you to leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. This would greatly help. And to show my appreciation, I'm running a competition for the chance to win 1 month's free online health coaching with myself. All you have to do is leave a review, take a screenshot of the review, or tag me in the post. You can do this through Facebook, Instagram, or you can send it to my email via my website. Today, I'll be interviewing Tony Farkery, who is a successful author of 3 books, a renowned public speaker, and a health coach with an impressive background. In this episode, we look at effective methods for goal setting with clients, how to connect with people on an emotional level for enhanced results, the ketogenic diet and who it's not for, public speaking tips, and much more. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did recording it. Now let's get started. Okay, today we've got Tony Farkery here, who's an author of 3 books, a nutritional expert, a corporate presenter, and a health coach. Tony's been a long-term friend of mine. We've worked together from humble beginnings at Fitness First and Space, and he's been somewhat of an unofficial mentor to me over the years. Tony's a wealth of knowledge, and I'm thrilled to have him here on the podcast today. So welcome, Tony.
G'day, Adam. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Now, just to lighten the mood, I always start with this one. What is one of the stupidest or most embarrassing things that you've done in the gym or training? And this can be doesn't have to be pertaining to yourself, but it could be you training your clients or something like that.
Well, Adam, it's interesting that you mention it because it actually was a topic of conversation that came up the other day with a client, and we were talking about bodily functions. And it so happens that many years ago, while training a client, and it was his first week training, and he wasn't accustomed to the exercise or the exercises at the time that were being prescribed. And I recall in a moment of hesitation, he was quite flatulent, and he tried to pass it off as me not hearing it. And of course, I raised the issue with him and I said it was quite fine. And so it really established a really good relationship from the offset that, you know, these things are quite natural. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that because last week I had a powerlifter on the podcast and she actually told me of the story, but she actually went through all the way, which was quite amusing. Right. But anyway, okay. we won't get stuck in the nitty-gritty of that. For those of you who might not know who Tony is, can you give us a bit of history on how you started your career and what you specifically do now?
Sure. Well, like most personal trainers, my career actually began in a unorthodox fashion, hence the term fashion. I actually graduated with a Bachelor of Arts in fashion many decades ago now. And after coming back from overseas working in Italy, I had a change of career, and I was always involved in the sporting and health areas by virtue of cycling. I was an endurance cyclist. And so I took to running spin classes at the time, and I still recall that it became something that I was really passionate about, and most importantly, motivating people. And someone mentioned to me at the time that you'd be really good as a personal trainer. And so I dismissed it. But then later, started doing some more investigating and went and did some courses, which here in Australia are the Cert 3 and Cert 4 in fitness. And then that led to, one thing. And subsequently, I became a personal trainer. So it was almost an accident of sort and something that I was never looking to do, but really just became a coincidence almost.
Yeah. And then how do you think, did any of that work in fashion influence your career as to date? Is there anything you sort of drew from that you use now as a health coach and as a presenter?
Absolutely. I think the biggest thing that I learned from being involved in fashion is the creative component and thinking outside the box. And as a coach and author and speaker, it's really been a privilege to think outside the box and think creatively as well. And it allows me to look at the client, assess the client from a multiple perspective or a three-dimensional perspective, as opposed to one dimension, which is just, you know, exercise alone.
Yeah. And were there teachers initially that had a big impact and shaped the way you went about sort of starting your career and things that might still impact you today? Was there anyone that comes to mind?
Yeah, absolutely. I still recall finishing my Cert 4 at the time, and the instructor was really into what was just emerging at the time, functional training. And he was a big proponent, and we would often talk about functional training. And of course, this was all new to me, having, you know, been a cyclist, and subsequently, you know, I'm learning about not using machines and using the body in three-dimensional patterns. And so that was quite instrumental, and it spawned this amazing learning curve where I then started looking into, you know, the likes of the Paul Check and Gary Gray and, you know, Michelle Delcourt, you know, Carlos Santana and the like. And so those people or coaches really became an influence for me in many ways.
Yeah. And sort of looking back, obviously we've all, you know, made a fair share of mistakes. Are there things that you think now, like, why did I do that with that client? And similarly, do you see people now when you go to commercial gyms and you see people doing the wrong thing? What's is there anything that comes to mind with that?
I guess one of the earliest recollections, Adam, was probably over-prescribing and over-training the client. And obviously, as a new person coming into the industry, it was my perception. And I guess my cycling background lent that component, as well as, you know, being a spin instructor, and that was give them value. And so my perceived value was, well, train the client hard, you know, let them be sore, walk away talking about, gee, how hard my trainer trained me and how sore I was. And so that was my initial mistake. And I discovered that it was really about ego. And so in the subsequent years, as I became more educated, it was less about that and giving the client what they actually needed.
Yeah, I think that's something we're all guilty of. And when you first start, you think more is better. If you give them, you know, 10 exercises, if you get 12, is going to be better. It comes back to, you know, how well you can recover from your exercise. But obviously that's something you learn as you go. When you're working on an individual basis with people, what sort of steps do you go through in terms of connecting with them? Because I know you don't just work from a strength and conditioning background, you sort of go into more sort of the emotional work, and we'll touch on your books a little bit later. But what are sort of methods and common steps that you peel back the layers with clients?
Yeah, absolutely, Adam. And it's a great question. So one of the mechanisms I use is really taking a multidimensional approach. And I guess my career spanning now 15 years, I've been fortunate to pick up so many various disciplines, and there's been this amazing journey and trajectory with clients that when I say multifaceted or multidisciplined, it really involves a integrated approach. And by that I mean looking at the various aspects of the client, not such the physical or the exercise component. So if a client comes to me and says, I want to lose weight in order to get fit and healthy for my upcoming wedding, it's not just about the wedding. There are other factors involved. So I look at the emotional component, look at their thoughts, what are their stresses like, look at their nutrition. How is their lifestyle balance? You know, what are their movements like? What are their posture like? Are they involved in a job where they're seated all day? Are they standing? And so forth. So really, you know, get in there and get to know the client. Who is this person? What are they about? What are their motives? Do they know their motives? What are their end results, and how can I become the facilitator to actually get them to their end results? And that's probably one of the most fascinating parts of the job for me.
Yeah, and with that, to get buy-in with a client, and I know you've worked with, and I've worked with as well, a lot of high-level executives. They've got that A-type personality. They want to come in. Mm. They've got that perception that they need to walk in the gym and they need to crush it for 45 minutes. How do you manage someone's expectations if you're talking about emotions and, you know, looking at their stress? And if they're unaware of that, how do you manage that initially?
I guess one of the things I've discovered, Adam, is integrating it into the session and allowing it to be an evolving process. So initially, again, one of the mistakes I made early in my career was just dumping so much information on the client. And it was really about showing how much I knew. Whereas in recent times, in the last decade, I would say it's been more about filtering and just dropping little bits of information along the journey, knowing that within a year, the client picks up so much more that is woven through conversation. And I guess what I try and do is just use conversation, you know, lighthearted matter to introduce ideas and concepts and have them work on the idea. So if it's someone dealing with a repressed emotion of anger and it's manifesting as, you know, some form of back pain, then it's really getting them to understand the idea, and it might be planting the seed and allowing them to go away and investigate it further and ask me for reference or help, and then I guide that journey. So it's a two-way process, not so much about me forcing anything onto the client, because ultimately if they're not going to assimilate it or digest it, then it's not going to work.
Yeah, okay. And just shifting into, now I know you're big, because we've spoken about it before in terms of goal setting and methods. What do you do for yourself? And if you've got, say, you know, a client, or even if another coach is listening to this podcast, what would you suggest for those three different people?
So in terms of goal setting for the client and myself?
Yeah, and for trainers as well, because a lot of coaches have contacted me and they listen to the podcast, and so I think it'd be helpful for them. If you know, all the methods are the same, then, you know, that's good as well, but I just thought I'd ask you that.
Sure, absolutely. So it's essentially working on goals that are specific to the client or specific to me. But it also involves reassessing those goals and why do I want to achieve that goal? So one of the biggest things that I've picked up in most recent times, and it's really been echoed through literature podcasts and the like, is when Simon Sinek talk about the whole idea of having a why. What is our motivator? Why are we motivated to achieve goals? Why do we want to achieve goals? What's the end result of achieving a goal, and who do we become when we achieve that goal? So what I try and do personally and with clients is to attach an emotional setting and an emotional component to the goal. So if we take the reference of the client earlier who was getting married, what is it about achieving her goal weight? And in terms of for the upcoming wedding, it might be that she wants to look good on the day for her husband and her family and so forth. So it's really tapping into that emotion. And when we tap into that emotion, we create this amazing connection, this why, that really fuels our actions, as opposed to having this, you know, really disconnection and trying to operate from the level of the mind, because then the mind and the body won't follow. But if we have a deep emotional connection, then we're more likely to adhere to the exercise, to the nutrition, to the lifestyle choices that are prescribed.
Yeah. And then in terms of like digging deep into the methods and the actual how you go about it, do you use visual cues? Do you use like pictures? Do you use, or is it all just written? Do you write your own goals out, or is it something you have digitally?
Sure. So on a personal level, I write my goals, and I write my goals on a daily basis. I tend to do it first thing in the morning when I wake up. So I generally have a routine where I allocate anywhere between 15 to 20 minutes, and also do visual guided imagery. And that is really get into a relaxed state, get into that subconscious learning state, and walk myself through what I'm trying to achieve. So I'll write my goals. I'll even use a method that I actually picked up from the speaker and author John Assaraf, who was in The Secret. And he talks about when you write your goals, use as much kinesthetic awareness as possible. So run your fingers over the written words, because as you know, when you write onto paper, it sort of leaves a little bit of an embossing. And so if you run your fingers over it as you're saying it out aloud, you're creating more of that kinesthetic visual connection, which is being developed and harnessed by the subconscious mind. So on a personal level, I try and use and engage as many senses as possible, and really look at my goals on a daily basis and create an emotive connection to them.
Yeah. And if your advice to perhaps a client or someone else who's looking to get into it, where would you start? Obviously, it might be a bit too much to bite off and say, dedicate 15, 20 minutes a day for visual imagery in the morning. But where would you point them in terms of just that starting point?
Sure, absolutely. I think the best thing would be just to have affirmations or goals that you review on a daily basis. And it's been said that it's probably good to have anywhere between 8 to 10 goals that you can review daily. So initially, what I get clients to do is to put them on a small card and have them laminated, or I'll laminate it on their behalf, and just have them carry that around and review it often. Now, obviously, given the smartphones, we can have our goals on our smartphone, but there's something quite novel about carrying around your goals in your pocket. So I encourage them to carry them around and review them as often as they can.
Yeah. Okay. So just shifting gears a little bit and speaking about presenting and corporate speaking, it's something you've done for many years now. And I think a lot of people do it for work and they might not have the skills, but you're obviously someone who's been quite successful at it, and you appear to be quite composed when you're on the stage. How do you connect and prepare for doing that sort of group setting and any stories you can think of?
Sure. So it's probably funny that I should mention this, but I'm mostly an introvert. And I guess given my creative background over the years and also my writing, I tend to gravitate towards time alone. And a part of being an introvert isn't so much that you're this recluse, but you're an individual that needs to reconnect with yourself and have time alone in silence. So I prefer that setting. Yet, interestingly enough, when I'm in front of an audience or a crowd, I absolutely thrive in that setting because there's a distance between you and the crowd. So in terms of preparation, there isn't so much that I prepare for other than doing vocal rehearsals. So they might be things such as going through certain vowels, you know, the consonants and the different vowels, and just reciting different words. I try not to visualize anything and just allow myself to be present and engaged in the moment when I'm with the audience. If I try and visualize an outcome, it might not be the outcome that I'm looking for. And often in an audience setting, you're thrown a curveball, whether it be a person asking a question or you know, audio malfunction or the like. So it happens. And so if you're preparing for it, that can stump you on the day. And it's been my experience that the best settings often happen when you least expect it. And fortunately, I had the privilege of being coached by a woman who was a somatic coach, speaking coach many years ago, Helen Omand. And her background was a dancer, and she really taught me how to be present and engaged in the moment, and just take what was happening with the audience, with the scenery, and use the entire stage in order to deliver the seminar.
Yeah. It's funny, I've seen people come up to you and say after you've done a presentation, you know, you're so good, you're natural in front of the crowd. But something that I think that people don't take into account is how much work you actually put into to being good at it. And it's not something that you woke up and all of a sudden you knew all these, you know, all the knowledge that you were presenting. So could you just talk about just how much sort of work you put in to get good and to get to the level where you're at now?
Well, I guess, Adam, all the work starts from, you know, it's an accumulative process, as you know, having done speaking yourself. It's really all about the work that you do day in, day out. And it's no secret that I love to read. And so I try and read, you know, anywhere between one or two books a week. So being a voracious reader, it's that preparation of knowledge and having things ready in your mind, but also delivery as well. So one of the things I often do before giving, you know, whether it be a seminar or a workshop or a keynote speech, is to spend time practicing. And so that can range anywhere from 1 week to 2 weeks. And I'll often stand in front of a mirror and look at my different cues. You know, how am I holding my head? Am I using too much of my hands? The other thing that I've also done, as you know, is recorded video blogs for probably the last 8 years. And the benefit of recording short video blogs of about 3 to 4 minute periods is to re-watch them again as you're editing them and look for little nuances that you do. So one of the things that I was doing a lot on video or on camera rather was when I was thinking, and this might be an NLP process, is I was looking up in order to try and capture my thoughts. And I noted my eyes looking up in the camera.
It's quite distracting for the viewer if you're doing that. And it's funny you say, because I notice things all the time when I record myself.
Yeah. So it's quite distracting. And so I worked at removing that habit. And the other habit that I often have is overusing my hands. And so, again, just being comfortable with using my hands. So it really comes down to refinement, looking at yourself, having other people tell you things. Often the things that people tell you, you don't notice about yourself, but they're really good points. And so if you want to become a great speaker, then it makes reason that you attend to those things and work on those things gradually.
Yeah. So is there any specific resource that spoke to you and that you looked into and it really, really sort of worked for you?
In terms of
like a book any courses you attended? I'm not sure if you did, but possibly a book.
For me, it was more or less trial and error. And again, working with the speaking coach, Helen, and she was instrumental in helping me develop my own speaking style. And I recall when we were first starting, she asked me, what is my archetype? And that was a really fundamental idea for me insofar as I didn't understand what an archetype was. And she said, well, are you the warrior? Are you the, the inquisitor, the scientist, the educator? How do you perceive yourself when you're conducting yourself as a speaker? And it was really a foreign concept to me. And so she saw me more as this wise individual, delivering counsel. And we then sort of worked on that idea of that I didn't necessarily have to be a person delivering concepts in this monotone fashion. So, for example, I could get excited one moment and, you know, really hark on about a concept or an idea and use body language, explore the stage, move around, use my presence. But then if I wanted to really emphasize a point, is then slow it down and really get the idea across to people so that they were really engaging. And so it was really about using the moment, using the stage. And so that's probably been my biggest influence.
Yeah. Obviously, there's been a huge evolution from being a spin instructor and now obviously to being a health coach and presenter and author. What stuff do you really enjoy about your work now?
I guess it's the diversity, Adam. It's really about being exposed to different things and different skills. And that's probably the biggest thing that I enjoy. So I could be writing articles for, you know, one or two days, and the next day I'm talking with clients and engaging with them and laughing. Next moment I'm reading books, watching videos, delivering seminars. So the diversity of skill that I'm attuned to or picking up on is just so fascinating, and that keeps me really enthusiastic and passionate about continual learning and developing and really becoming the best that I can be. Because when I'm at my best, Adam, then I'm able to communicate the message to the clients or the audiences in the best possible fashion so that they receive it the way that it's intended.
Yeah, and you get feedback on how you're going to, do you get, you know, on the internet, do people, you know, write to you and say, you know, really love your stuff here? And also, do you receive on the opposite end of the spectrum any sort of negative feedback, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess one of the mechanisms, as you know, is that when you're in this field and writing and speaking, you're not going to be everyone's cup of tea. And so there are going to be instances where people don't agree with what you have to say. Generally speaking, I tend not to, 99.9% of the time, I don't respond to negative feedback, only because most of them are people that want to get something off their chest. They're generally passers-by. They don't know your work well enough. The ones that do, they're more or less wanting to engage with you on the topic. So they might have read four or five articles, and they'll take a point and actually discuss that. And they're the feedback that I actually enjoy. The best part is obviously receiving really good feedback or changing people's lives in the subtlest way. And I had two instances recently that really, I guess touch a nerve and hit home why you do this. And it was one young chap in the US who spoke about being a marriage counselor and having read my articles for the past two or three years, and how much of an influence those articles have been in his own personal growth, and that have helped him as a marriage counselor. And he's been quite successful in helping people stay together. And so you often think that the seeds that you've planted in your articles have this amazing effect to reach people in ways that you don't suspect. And then in another case, another young person talked about or wrote to me talking about wanting to commit suicide, and having read a number of my articles, wanted to explore and understand more of the idea of self-belief and self-esteem. And that prompted him to seek counseling with a trained therapist. So again, I often think of myself as the planter of seeds and allowing people to find their own journey.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to look at it. And I think you never know who's reading your stuff. And I think the beautiful thing with yourself being an author as well is the fact that you write those books and they're out there for, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years time, someone could still be reading your work. So the work you do now has got a huge return on what you do. So just moving into your books, can you explain the process about how you decided you wanted to write your first book, and what was the premise of the book?
Sure. So that really came about again through accident, and it was really about noticing patterns with clients on a one-to-one basis. And it was more along the lines of emotions. And it's an interesting concept because as a personal trainer, you're far removed from understanding your client's emotions because it's about the physical component. It's about getting them in the gym, having them lose weight or get stronger or fix their posture. But I noticed with clients over a 10-year period that there was this common theme of emotions, and that was that as they became healthier, as they became fitter, as they improved their rehabilitation or they overcame their back pain, their emotions, their negative emotions, and I use negative in this context only because the negative emotion may have contributed to the back pain, or it may have ignited the back pain, but subsequently these emotions began to heal. So the book was a way of noticing these ideas. And then I began to work with a thought leader at the time who helped me condense this material and put it into a concept that would then become a book, and then also a learning program in terms of being presented. So I then presented the program, The Power to Navigate Life, to companies like Ericsson's on behalf of Bupa Australia. So what started off as an idea then developed into a program and then developed into a book with the help of some amazing people who really took notice of the concepts and also identified with those concepts.
And with that, what you were teaching and the actual concept in the book, could you just talk about that and how it pertains to health as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea was two concepts. Well, it was one main concept, but two ideas. And the idea is that there are really no mistakes throughout our life, and that we have the idea of either we're parked in life or we're navigating life. And so I created this wheel, and it was almost an infinity symbol, which looked like a yin and yang. And the idea of parked is a concept that I picked up reading a book many years ago on relationships. And the author spoke about men staying parked in relationships, even though they were toxic relationships. And it really hit home to me that often that really describes the way we approach life. Sometimes we're stuck. And if we think about what parked means, you know, we're stuck, we're stagnant, we're not really moving anywhere in life, whether it be our career, our finances, our health, our relationships. On the other side of the spectrum, we're navigating life, so we're free, we're discovering, there's this sense of freedom. And so looking at The Power to Navigate Life, it's really helping people get out of that parked state and move into the navigating state and discover their own freedom. But also noting that sometimes that we can become parked and stagnant, and it's okay to be parked, but realizing that when you do, that it's a call or a sign to take action or do some investigating or self-examination in order to move away from that parked state and move into the navigating state.
Yeah. And just quickly, do your two other books, the titles of those and the just sort of brief synopsis just for people so they can look those up?
Sure. So the books are available on Amazon, and the second book is called Reconstructing the Past to Create a Remarkable Future. And again, with all three books, I've had the great fortune of attracting some international best-selling authors. The first book had Dr. Eldon Taylor, who's a former psychologist and worked a lot with criminals. The second book, Forward, was written by Dr. Joe Vitale, who many would know from The Secret. And so Reconstructing the Past to Create a Remarkable Future is really about looking at the past in a new way, healing the past. A lot of us carry our past as baggage throughout our life, and bring that burden of toxic emotions and negative beliefs into our life, and it really tarnishes our life's experience. And so it's about healing the past to create this prosperous and bright future. And the most recent book is Awaken Your Authentic Self. And that's really a call for looking at who is this person beneath these thoughts and ideas that you have about yourself. You know, for example, you know, my name is Tony and I'm a personal trainer, but you know, who is Tony beyond the personal trainer and the label of this man that speaks and writes? Who is the essence of Tony? Who is the spiritual component of Tony? And it's taking terminology and putting them into ways that people can easily identify and assimilate.
Oh, awesome. Well, I'll put those in the show notes and I'll have a link to each of those books. Just sure. Touching on the writing process, and I know you've obviously written blog articles for many years now, but what are some like habits and tips for people that are contemplating writing their first book and that you learnt from the process?
Sure. So one of the things that I develop with the book writing process is accumulate material. And so I write daily. And one of the really great benefits that I've had, and I guess this probably comes from my fashion background, is that creativity component and being attentive to your environment. And sometimes inspiration happens in the most unlikely ways. Often enough, I'll be talking with a client who'll say something and it'll just be a phrase. It could be a word. And she puts context, or he puts context and meaning into that phrase. And that is an inspiration for an article. And subsequently, that article, you know, is received incredibly well by people in large. So it's looking at your environment, being attentive to what's happening in the news, thoughts. I notice my own thoughts. And that's why being an introvert and being alone in silence allows me to connect with my thoughts and understand what is actually happening in my world and happening in others' world, and take that on board and almost digest that information and put it out into the world as in terms of writing.
And did you use your blog as like a bit of a sounding board? So seeing the analytics, okay, this one really resonated with people. Is that how you came up with some of those ideas?
Yeah, absolutely. So writing was a really good, or blogging was a really good way to formulate the material for the book, insofar as you could see via the metrics of what people were responding to. And blogging is fascinating in terms of it allows you to test the market, test what ideas, what terms. For example, when I first started, I was using a lot of spiritual terms that people just did not digest. And I had this perception that I was appealing to a largely male audience. And it turned out that my audience in most recent times has become more females, aged between 18 to about 36 years old, who really assimilate that that knowledge. But blogging, yeah, Adam, is an idea to get that information out into the world, see how people respond to it, look at the comments, see what they're liking, what they don't like, and take note of it, and you know, put it into an Excel spreadsheet. So at the end of the year, you know what has actually worked and what hasn't worked.
Yeah. So moving on to nutrition, you're someone who's had a lot of experience and done a lot of testing on nutrition, what works for yourself and with clients. If you could just elaborate on your philosophy behind nutrition and how you sort of intertwine it with coaching as well.
Sure. So nutrition has been a fundamental component for me. I come from a Lebanese family, and both parents grew up in agricultural backgrounds. And so planting their own vegetables was really fundamental to my growing up. I've also got two sisters who are also really engaged in cooking and whole foods. And so as young children, we would help out with mum and dad, you know, growing vegetables, and we learned about how to use those vegetables, how to grow them, how to cultivate them, you know, adding manure, what type of season certain vegetables grew. And so my whole concept behind nutrition is about whole foods, you know, getting back to nature. And I try not to subscribe to diets or fads insofar as, you know, the paleo diet or ketogenic diet and so forth. So if anyone asks me, what diet are you on? I just say I follow predominantly a whole food diet and tend to stay less away from packaged foods. And that's something I really bring across with clients in terms of looking at their overall nutritional balance and trying to remove offending foods that either cause inflammation in the body or are not conducive to their long-term health. And again, it's a gradual process, as you know, Adam. And it's not about, you know, removing things initially, but subsequently making slow, gradual changes that are almost under the radar of the mind. For example, as you know, if a client's having six cups of coffee a day and you tell them to cut it back to one, the brain takes it's almost a fight or flight response, and so it's alerted or flagged in the brain. Yet if you said to them, why don't you cut one coffee a day? Now, if that's done gradually, and this is a Japanese concept as well that I researched over the years and really fell in love with, and it was the idea of small changes over time have a gradual or a larger impact. And so really it's about just imparting small bits of wisdom and allowing the client to find their own way.
Yeah, yeah, it's an actual method that I use a lot when I get someone initially in. I won't tell them they can't have, you know, these foods. I will just put in a group of foods, and it'll eventually just push out those other foods. You'll say, you know, you've got a minimum goal of having, you know, three meals with green vegetables in it, and you need a certain amount of protein. And just by doing that, it's sort of, people get, the satiety goes away, they're less hungry, they're less likely to eat the bad foods. But something I don't know whether I picked it up from you, but just touching on, are there any resources that would encapsulate your philosophy, or are there books that have changed your approach to nutrition?
I guess one of my founding books or resources at the time was the Czech Principles and Philosophies. And that really sparked my own discoveries. And of course, Czech talks about, you know, the Western Price type of model of eating, eating close to the earth, and so forth. And so I would probably encourage people to start with that as a research, as a resource, as an initial resource, and just allow it to take you where it needs to go, because everyone's going to have a starting point and a different route or a route to go down. For me, it was that Paul Czech principle, or that Czech philosophy of getting back to whole foods, which he no doubt has borrowed, and it's been influenced from many resources over the years. But again, it's getting back to that whole food idea. So again, the Western Price type nutritional model.
And just touching on, you've coached me through going into ketosis, and you've done extensive research yourself. Could you just tell us about your background with experimentation with a ketogenic diet?
Sure. So the ketogenic diet was an interesting idea. It started off as something that I'd read about, predominantly because I was heavily into cycling at the time, and I thought I'd try it for 6 weeks, and that 6 weeks, of course, then became 3 years. So I was basically in ketosis for 3 years, and during that time, there were some amazing people doing research in that area, such as Dr. Stephen Finney, Jeff Volek,
Dom D'Agostino.
Dom D'Agostino. And so they really became a fundamental component of the research for me. And it was just a really good period in terms of understanding my body better. And I would take blood samples on a regular basis and just note my ketone levels. My body changed immensely during that 3-year period. I think I got down to about 10% body fat at one stage. And so it was a really good way of understanding the whole concept of ketosis and how it works at that sort of deeper levels. But in hindsight, if I were to do it again, there were things that I'd probably change now. And that's only because of what I know now about, you know, the gut microbiome and how our gut bacteria now affects every aspect of our health and physiology.
Yeah. And what are the steps if you were taking someone through going into ketosis? What are the macronutrient splits look like? What's the premise for someone who might not understand what a ketogenic diet is?
Sure. So I guess the basic premise for being in ketosis is that you're using fat for fuel as opposed to carbohydrates. So effectively, you know, ketones is the byproduct of burning fat for fuel. So effectively, it's suggested anywhere from about 50% fat, you know, up to about 80% fat is the in terms of the macronutrient ratio. I was averaging probably about 83-85% fat at the time, which was really high. And my average carbohydrate intake for the week was probably between 20 to 30 grams of carbohydrates, which meant that protein was quite low in that mix of things. There was a Polish doctor who in the early 1970s, and he wrote a book called I think it's Optimal Living or Optimal Health. The name escapes me now. But he was a Polish doctor that worked with the Polish army, and he was noticing a lot of people with ailments and mental disorders. And so it was a way to help remedy those situations. And he discovered this ideal ratio, and effectively the books were translated from Polish to English, and I bought them and began investigating those and followed exactly his macronutrient ratios. So in terms of getting into ketosis, it's suggested that it can take anywhere from 6 weeks to 12 weeks. A lot of people want to push it quicker. And as you know, Adam, you know, the quicker you go into ketosis, you develop these side effects. Yeah. And the side effects, as you know, can range from anywhere to this nervousness, this anxiety, to muscle cramping, to headaches, to flu-like symptoms. So I generally start clients off on a low carbohydrate diet, and I'll have them stay on the low carbohydrate diet probably anywhere between 6 to about 8 weeks. I generally prefer 8 to 12 weeks, and it's just so they can assimilate, get used to it, get their mind around the idea of the nutrition involved, you know, the type of shopping and foods they need to purchase. And once they've adapted and I've seen that they're starting to lose weight, and they're getting comfortable, then we start fine-tuning it to get more into ketosis. And it's probably worth mentioning that during my 3-year period of being in ketosis, I discovered a lot of, as I mentioned earlier, about the gut microbiome. So I really heavily into using fiber in the diet, and if need be, supplementing with external fiber sources such as, you know, partially hydrolyzed guar gum, which is a wonderful fiber source and doesn't tip or doesn't kick you out of ketosis.
Yeah. What do you say to people who worry about eating that much fat? I know there's this whole perceived notion that, you know, if you're eating that much fat, your cholesterol is going to go up and you're going to get heart disease. What do you say to those people?
So I guess it's an individual basis, and ultimately one needs to be incredibly sensible about this, because the interesting part about the conversation is that a member of my family has familial hypercholesterolemia, which means that her body overproduces cholesterol. You know, the interesting component is that we need to be mindful of what is actually happening with our cholesterol levels. So I had my blood cholesterol levels taken, and they were sent to a lab, and I followed up with the head of the lab at the time and posed a few questions, and he wrote back saying that although my cholesterol levels were incredibly high, that the ratios were very, very healthy and safe. So that was echoed by my doctor at the time. But again, it's really getting yourself checked, understanding your blood values, but also being aware and careful of what the medical community are prescribing. Because at the end of the day, if your cholesterol levels are high, they're going to put you on statins, because that's a red flag. And what was really interesting is that my blood cholesterol levels normalized during that three-year period I was in ketosis, and then also normalized when I reintroduced carbohydrates back again.
Yeah, and can you just talk about who ketosis isn't for? I think a lot of people see, and you know, it's glamorized on Facebook and on the internet about, you know, and they sensationalize the benefits of ketosis. But can you just talk about how hard it is for people to actually sustain that level of ketosis for long periods of time?
Yeah, absolutely. Ketosis is incredibly difficult. It was probably the most challenging 3 years I've ever undertaken. And I looking back on it now, I don't know how I lasted 3 years. And probably the biggest thing, Adam, was being kicked out of ketosis, as you know. So to be in ketosis, you've got to follow it to a T. And it's almost like the, you know, angry next door neighbor. If you play the music too loud, you know, they're going to get angry and let you know about it. And ketosis is exactly the same. Yeah. So if you overconsume carbohydrates, and again, I'm really into hacking, you know, and I absolutely enjoy it. So for me, it was finding my tolerance. So the minimum that I could sustain carbohydrates was about 20 to 30 carbohydrates, grams of carbohydrates. The maximum where I'd get kicked out of ketosis was anywhere between 60 to 70. And that's pretty low in the context of things. But when you get kicked out of ketosis, you're in this, you know, flu-like state for about 2 or 3 days where you've got these headaches, you feel lethargic, you know, brain fog. And so, you know, you might go to a birthday, for example, and eat some birthday cake. But it becomes about, you know, being wise with your choices, knowing that, you know, you can't do this because you're going to suffer 2 or 3 days of being, you know, having these keto flu-like symptoms. So, yes, it's incredibly hard. So for anyone listening, start with a low-carbohydrate diet and just work yourself gradually down and see how you feel as opposed to jumping straight into ketosis.
Yeah, I think you used the analogy when I was going to ketosis. You said to me, it's like dealing with an angry girlfriend. You know, if you're nice to her, ketosis will be good to you. But if you do the wrong thing by the girlfriend, it's definitely not fun. And I can attest to that. I remember when I was actually getting I did several obviously blood tests when I was doing it, and I remember being in doing an glucose tolerance test where you ingest 70 grams of glucose. And I'd been in ketosis for, I think, 2 or 3 months. And I remember the feeling of sitting there ingesting that, and you could feel your brain get this rush of glucose. But then literally 40 minutes after that, I was in a world of hurt. So it's definitely something that people need to definitely research and look into. And I definitely recommend anyone who's looking into ketosis for the benefits, because there are like a lot of benefits, cognitive benefits, and obviously endurance. Sports can benefit from being in ketosis as well. but it's something that you want to attack and get perhaps a coach, someone to, who's been through
Absolutely.
That process before, is huge. And I think your testament to that, you know, you've had a you know, public speaking coach, and you've had, you know, numerous coaches and mentors. Is there anyone that comes to mind that's made a big impact and sort of mentored you in your career?
There's probably been many, Adam. There have been many people, but also resources. And we often think that mentors need to be people, but mentors can be books. And again, owing to my constitution of being this introvert, I really get a lot of my mentoring from the books that I read. But if I need mentorship on an area, so for example, in the last probably 7-8 years, I've used an editor to edit my writing, that is. And so I write daily and weekly, and I send my articles to an editor who runs through the types of errors and mistakes, and that's been an immense learning curve. And one of the interesting things is that you don't necessarily need to use the same mentor during your entire learning process. So I've probably gone through 6 or 7 editors because I've noticed that the same mistakes keep popping up. So, for example, if I'm start using the word "that" in my writing a lot, that same editor is picking that up every time over a year, and so I'm not improving. So I'll find another editor, and hopefully I've learned not to use the word "that" anymore. And then the next editor might notice that my grammar isn't fine, so I fine tune that. So it's really about using mentors to help you, but noticing when you hit a stalemate with mentors as well, and reach out to new people as well.
Okay, so we're almost at the end now. What are some personal habits and routine? Obviously, you're a high performer and you've done well over the last 15 years. What are your sort of non-negotiables for the day?
I guess it starts with early morning habits. So it's, you know, getting out of bed at a certain time. And, you know, despite the literature or, the articles online sprawled across online that say, you know, successful performers need to get up early at 5:30 and so forth. I'm a big believer of getting up according to your body clock. So for me, it's around 7:30 a.m. I generally get to bed at about 10:30. So I try and get about 8 to 9 hours of sleep, and my body really needs that. So I developed this ritual in the morning of, you know, getting together with my goals, doing the guided imagery, and establishing that 15, 20-minute period of being alone with myself, reviewing my goals, and sometimes even writing out new goals as well. Following from that is then, moving into some sort of an action, whether it be, some type of stretching or mobilizations or exercise. So generally it might be doing some sprints or some resistance training. And generally what I'll try and do is do this in a fasted state. So one of the benefits, Adam, that I picked up of being in ketosis is using fasting or intermittent fasting rather in my everyday life. And it turned out that it was something that I was always doing as a cyclist. And we used to do these fasting rides where we'd get up in the morning, we'd jump on our bikes and go out and do 4 to 6 hours of endurance cycling and not actually eat food until we got home. So I generally fast or intermittent fast for at least 14 to 16 hours every day, 7 days a week. And then try and have breakfast after I've come back from training and exercise at around about 10:30 or 11:30 a.m. And again, so those are the things that are non-negotiable: time alone, exercise, nutrition, having, eating certain foods, again, whole foods as well, and starting my day on a positive note as much as I can.
Yeah, and then after that, so you've had that, do you then sit down to write? And then what does the rest of the day look like?
Sure. So from then, it generally goes straight into the writing. So probably about 70% of my time is spent writing these days, probably more. So generally sit down to write, and I'll write anywhere from about 11:30, 12 o'clock, straight through to about 4 or 5, sometimes even 6 p.m., and then at that time, I find that in the afternoon, I'm starting to get really drowsy, tired. I'll have a 20-minute nap. And I've been doing this now for about 5 years. And it's been really instrumental in my writing, insofar as a 20-minute nap helps me to recover, but also opens my cognitive function. And then generally in the evening, I'll edit my work. And I find that I'm a lot more alert and I have more energy throughout the evening. The other thing I also do is later in the evening is read. So I try and read for about an hour or two most nights, as much as I can, and try not to read on the internet. So I sit down either with a physical book or a Kindle and read off that.
And is there anything in particular at the moment that you're, I know you're always looking into new things, is what area are you sort of looking into researching and reading about currently?
I'm on Goodreads. I use the Goodreads function, and I set myself yearly limits of certain books. So I've just reached that limit. So at the moment, I'm quite fascinated by the idea of rereading books. And it's a really novel thing that's come up lately in the last probably 4 to 6 months. And a lot of the great, speakers and authors and successful people talk about rereading books. So at the moment, I'm going through my entire list of the year and picking out notable books that have really resonated for me and taking those principles and really sitting down with them. I must also add that one of the things I'm really fascinated with reading is reading old literature. So, self-help books or motivational, inspirational books that were written in the early 1900s, the Napoleon Hills, the Dale Carnegies and the likes, So that's an area that I love reading over and over again because I really pick up a lot of gems from those people.
Yeah. Okay, so we've come to the last bit, which are the rapid fire questions. Now, you don't necessarily have to answer them rapid fire answers. You can take as long as you want. But the first book, which is connects nicely, is what's your all-time favorite training book? And I'll throw in a self-help book, considering the work you do.
Sure. So I'd probably say all time is a tie. If I had to say self-help book, it would probably be The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho. As a training book, my first book that was given to me 15 years ago was Paul Check's book, How to Eat and Move and Be Healthy.
Yeah, awesome. And do you have any quotes that you live your life by or anything of that nature that you might have come up with yourself?
There's a quote that I've got written on my whiteboard, which I'll turn to and read out in a moment. But it's I often put quotes up that I make an intention of reading at least 4 or 5 times a day and reflecting on them. And the quote that I have up at the moment is by Og Mandino, and who was a motivational speaker. And he said, failure will never overtake me if my determination to succeed is strong enough. Yeah. So, yeah, that's a favorite quote of mine at the moment.
Yeah. And just on that quote, one of my favorite quotes that I've heard you use is the one that you finish a lot of your seminars about minds being open. Can you say that one?
Yeah. So I generally start the seminar and I always ask people to, I say to them, minds are like parachutes. They work best when open.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that quote. It's one of my favorite ones that you use. Now, what do you do for fun on the weekends? What do you do to relax and unwind?
So I have two nephews and a niece, all of whom are under 7 years old. and connecting with them and seeing them often. And that has been an absolute joy to my life, because it's taught me how to be a child again and connect on a child like level as opposed to childish. And children allow you to have fun, and you're forced to have fun. So for me, it's spending quality time with them, mainly outdoors, and, you know, playing in the park and doing activities and watching them move and understanding the human body at a better level.
Yeah, awesome. Do you have a cheat meal that you would go to?
My vice is always chocolate, has been chocolate for many years throughout my life. So I try and gravitate to dark chocolate every now and again. But in terms of junk food, I was having this conversation with my sister recently, and we were talking about how long haven't you eaten, you know, McDonald's or KFC. And it's probably been a decade since I've actually eaten any junk food. But generally, dark chocolate is my vice.
Yeah. And if you had to pick one, would it be squat or a deadlift?
My preference has always been squats, only because I have a congenital kyphosis, which means that deadlifts make it incredibly difficult for me to keep perfect form. So I definitely say squats.
Yeah. If you could be known for one thing, what would it be?
As I said earlier, people often say that you're the planter of seeds. So planting ideas in people's minds and letting them or allowing them to do the work and investigate and find their own path, their own journey.
Yeah. And what does the next 12 months look like for you? What's in the pipeline for Tony?
So it's writing the fourth book. Next year, I haven't planned the topic or even the title at this stage, but also looking forward to working with a well-renowned international author on a mentoring basis as well. And my ultimate goal is tapping into the US market with my books and doing speaking tours over there.
Oh, awesome. And what's the best place for people to get in contact with you?
Sure. So it would probably be on my website, which is Tony Fakhry, which is TonyFahkry.com. And certainly just send me a message. I'm also on LinkedIn for those of you in the professional space, and also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, TonyFahkry.com.
Awesome. And do you have any parting words for listeners or actions that they should take after listening to this?
No, I guess we've probably covered a lot of information here today, Adam. And it's, again, if I had to summarize that information, is move as often as possible, preferably in 3D or three dimensions, eat whole foods, and just understand your constitution, that is, understand your thoughts and emotions and make peace with them.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Tony. It's been great to have you on, and great to finally ask some of these questions. I think being friends, sometimes you don't sit down and ask these questions, so it's a bit of an excuse for me to get these out of the way.
Thanks, Adam. It's been an absolute pleasure, and thanks for all the listeners out there for putting up with me for the last hour.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Tony is a wealth of knowledge and a down-to-earth practitioner. I'll link to his website and resources in the show notes that can be found on my website, hulk-strength.com. Please subscribe to this podcast through iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or Google Play so you can be updated on the next episode. Plus, if you'd like some of my free training resources, subscribe to my email list at hulk-strength.com. I have a number of free documents for goal setting, nutrition, and training programs. Also, don't forget to leave a review in iTunes or Stitcher for a chance to win a month's free online training with me. Stay strong, and I'll catch you next time.